So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Aaron to the stage.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone.
Is this on?
All right. All right, so usually when I do this, the first question that everyone is always wondering is, what is a chief storyteller and how did I end up doing this job for the city of Detroit? So I was appointed by the mayor last year. I just marked about a year and a half working for the mayor now. I come from a journalism background, and I went to State, went to the J School there, worked at the State News, and kind of prepared myself to be a journalist forever, right? But anybody that has worked in media knows that the industry has changed a lot. So I started off in newspapers, worked in the online space, worked in automotive journalism, freelance for a while, did a stint at an ad agency, wound up being editor of a magazine, and somehow along the way, I sort of built this niche for myself, talking about the city of Detroit from the perspective of a Detroiter that's actually from Detroit. I say that with pride because one of the defining moments in my life did happen in undergrad at State. I was a freshman in 2002, fall of 2002, some of you may remember, that is when the movie 8 Mile came out. And I remember being so excited seeing the trailer for 8 Mile because you see the Rensen skyline in the trailer, and you see all these recognizable streets and whatnot, and you know all of the Detroit kids in East Lansing at the time, we were just like, yes, a movie about Detroit, and like we live here, right? So, but we were having a debate in our what is now called WRA now, but back in the day it was called American Thought and Language. We were having a debate in class one day. And I remember the professor asking, 8 Mile's coming out. What do people think about Detroit? And before any of the people from Detroit could kind of answer the question, a couple of kids from the suburbs of Detroit answered the question. They were just like, yeah, you know, once you cross Oscar Road, everything goes to hell, right? Or, you know, my dad did this or my mom did this and it's nothing but abandoned blocks and it's nothing but this and you get robbed the moment you cross 8 Mile and stuff like that. And all the Detroit kids are looking at each other like, we want to fight, right? You know, you know how we can make eye contact with each other and know exactly what we're saying without saying a word? It was getting so heated in that moment. And I sort of knew, like, from the rest of my life, I'd be defending Detroit ever since. So, of course, during that moment, you know, people got up and said, you know, Detroit certainly has its issues. You know, we don't deny that. But there are good parts about Detroit. You know, I grew up in a neighborhood where everyone knew each other. I grew up in a neighborhood that was very familiar. It was the type of place where you could make a home. And it survived a lot of the different eras of Detroit. It survived the recessions of the 2000s. It survived the bankruptcies of the automotive industry. It survived all of these different things. I can go to my block that I grew up on today in 2018, and it'll look exactly like 1996 when we first moved there. And 1996 looks exactly like 1943 when the house was actually built. So all of these different things sort of play into how I ended up working in the mayor's office, because I did 2 books. I did a lot of freelance writing, all about, you know, trying to debunk some of the mysteries and stereotypes about Detroit, because a lot of the, we had the recession in 2009, and then the foreclosure crisis happened, and then what was happening in between that and then was we had a mayor going to prison. So there was just nonstop media coverage from the New York Times, from Time, and Newsweek, and Wall Street Journal, and CBS News, and NBC News, all of these national outlets coming into Detroit and just showing all of the devastation. You know, how many pictures did we see of the train station? How many pictures did we see of the Packer plant? There was an NBC News Dateline special where you saw people lined up around the block to get raccoon meat, because apparently at the time, food was so expensive, the only thing people in Detroit were eating were raccoons. So a lot of people took great offense to that because we were saying, like, Detroit has its problems, but is it really this bad? You know, is the train station really the only functioning, you know, photo in Detroit that we can use to illustrate what the city looks like? People forget that the city is 143 square miles. People forget that although at its height in the 1940s, there were 2 million people, there are about 700,000 people living, breathing, working, playing in the city every day. So I was writing a lot of things about that. I was writing a lot of things for Jalopnik and all these different places about what life is like in Detroit. You know, look at all these different neighborhoods that we have to offer. Look at all these different businesses that have never left the city of Detroit. Look at all these people that are making Detroit a home. The media narrative sort of shifted to out of bankruptcy and out of corruption and all the negative things that were going on. And then it sort of shifted to something else that annoyed longtime Detroiters, and that the imagery of Detroit be shifted from black and brown faces living in poverty, living in peril, to new people coming from New York, coming from San Francisco, coming from Austin, coming from all of the expensive cities, and they're opening coffee shops and startups and venture capitalist firms and barbecue restaurants across from the train station and all these different types of things. And suddenly, the face of Detroit is typically a 25 to 35 year old white male or what have you, not from the city of Detroit. And if you know anything about the demographics of Detroit, it's a mostly black city. It's a Latino city. It's an Arab American city. It's welcoming to everybody, you know, and it's not to say that, like, oh, you can't move to Detroit because you're from the suburbs, or you can't move to Detroit because you're from New York. But the media narrative became so imbalanced, right? It started to look like every time you picked up a paper now, you started to see people who weren't originally from Detroit. And again, the longtime Detroiters were saying, well, I've had this barbecue restaurant open for 40 years. I've had this coffee shop open for 20 years. I've been living in the neighborhood and maintaining the neighborhood. I've been, you know, cutting my grass. I've been fixing up my house and all of that. But I don't get the same, even, you know, a quarter of as much of attention as someone who's sort of fresh to Detroit. So I started writing about that, too. And it caught the attention of the mayor's office because he noticed some of the things that I was doing was, is the PowerPoint going? I just realized. It should be. Yeah, okay. So it caught the attention of the mayor's office because the mayor's office really wanted to figure out a way to connect more with the neighborhoods of Detroit. The mayor was going to a bunch of community meetings and noticing that people were saying, hey, you know, thank you for fixing the lights, thank you for fixing the sidewalks, but what about, you know, where can I see myself on TV? Where can I see myself in a print product? Where can I see myself online? And so I was tapped to essentially create this resource in our media services department where I manage a team of photographers, videographers, and writers. We produce content for our cable channel, we produce content on the daily website, and we're starting to inch towards some sort of print publication. I'm not sure how we're going to do that yet, but we are moving there. From the perspective of city government, but not necessarily putting like the government stamp on it, right? It won't have like the mayor's face on everything. It won't have the city council's face or the city clerk's face on everything. But we kept saying to ourselves, if people in Detroit are thinking that they can't see themselves anywhere, and we've got these four cable channels, and we've got all this, all these websites where we can populate content, why don't we use some of these existing resources to tell stories about Detroit? So we've all heard of Midtown, right? Everybody's been to Midtown. Who has heard of Castle Rouge? Nobody's heard of Castle Rouge. Exactly. It's one of those things where there are so many different neighborhoods in Detroit beyond your typical Midtown and Corktown and whatnot. We, at the mayor's office, we believe that one of the things we need to do is increase knowledge of all the different neighborhoods. There's 213 different neighborhoods across the city of Detroit. I use Castle Rouge as an example because when we were pitching Amazon last year, didn't quite work out right, but one of the things Amazon was looking for was a place where a family could make a home, a place that could be walkable, for Amazon employees in a place that could be affordable. Like, you know, millennials, we got student loan debt, and, you know, maybe a $1 million house in Indian Village is out of reach, but we have plenty of other neighborhoods that have those homes in the, you know, 50K to 250K range, I guess. Castle Rouge is one of those places. It's on the far west side of Detroit. It's a lot of mid-century homes, which is the trend now. Everybody loves those old mid-century ranches, and they put mod furniture in them and whatnot. It's close to Rouge Park, which has a walking trail and, you know, two Olympic-sized swimming pools, which is unheard of in Detroit unless you actually go to Rouge Park. It's got, you know, hiking trails and all these things that you can find in a metro park in the suburbs. And you can walk there from Castle Rouge, but people don't know about it because people don't go to Castle Rouge. People don't go to Yorkshire Woods or I'm trying to think of some of the other neighborhoods that we've talked about, Green Acres, the Far West Side, Old Redford, all these places that have all of these attractive housing options, but people don't know about them. Business corridors. We all know about Michigan Ave going up and down near the train station and Slows and Bobcat Bonnie's and all of that. But the most trafficked business corridor, not necessarily Michigan Ave, is Verner, Southwest, right? You go up and down Verner, what do you see? Taqueria El Rey and all the different taco places. But not just that. There's like probably, you know, thousands of dollars going up and down Verner every day. So one of the things that the mayor's office did was start the Strategic Neighborhood Fund, where we have almost $150 million going into commercial corridors like Verner, Livermore on the northwest side, Grand River on the northwest side, Warren on the east side, Jefferson between the Grosse Pointe border and downtown and things like that to, again, bring more attention into different Detroit neighborhoods. And this is what I do. So I go out and talk to people in those corridors. I go out and talk to small businesses in those corridors. I go out and talk to churches, religious organizations. We have, of course, we have a growing Latino population down in Southwest, but a lot of people don't know, hey, that will work. did I just go through the, okay. Oops. Okay. while we wait, a lot of people aren't aware that we have a very large Bangladeshi population that's growing on the northeast side. I'd like to talk about Banglatown because it's one of those places where it's, when my mother was a kid back in the 60s, that was a neighborhood where a lot of African Americans had started to move to as the city started to integrate more. Then when I took her back there as an adult, she couldn't believe it because you see all these Bangladeshi flags hanging from the porches and whatnot. But it's a community that doesn't get a lot of attention in Detroit because there is a language barrier. But also, you know, like I said, the media narrative is really focused on downtown and midtown and what Dan Gilbert is doing and things like that. And Dan Gilbert is doing a lot of good stuff. But we have to remember that Detroit is not just Dan Gilbert, right? It's not just Ford and the train station. It's all of our different immigrant communities moving into the city. It's our LGBT community moving into the community as well. So a lot of people don't realize that our neighborhoods like East English Village and University District, it's not just integrating more than it has been in the last 20 years. It's also becoming a more LGBT welcoming place in the city. So one of the things we did at the mayor's office was start an LGBT task force where we are communicating more with LGBT residents, LGBT businesses, and seeing like, okay, we're taking Detroit into the future now. How do we make sure that we're not just welcoming to immigrants or people of different races, but you know, LGBT residents, Muslim residents, people who you know, have different faiths or whatnot, making sure that everyone is welcome in the city of Detroit. And then, again, they call on me to go interview people who are making their homes in Detroit. So one of the things that has been sort of a passion point for me is the fact that every time June comes along, June is Pride Month. That's when all the newspapers and all the TV stations, you know, start rolling out the rainbow flag. And then for 30 days, everything is gay. And then the other 11 months out of the year, it's like, not anymore. You know, all the flags come down and whatnot. I made it a priority to, you know, I assigned one of the writers. I said, we've got to keep LGBT coverage on the neighborhoods and on our cable channels rolling 365 days out the year. Because I don't want to make it seem like, okay, we're only going to talk about the gays in June, we're only going to talk about Muslims during Ramadan, and we're only going to talk about black people during February. You know, we can't keep doing that. We have to go back to what the model we've sort of adopted is, you know, taking the place of the community reporting that used to be in newspapers many, many years ago. You used to pick up the Free Press and the News back in the 90s, and they used to have like a weekly community insert or even a daily community insert. Those days are gone now. You know, there are fewer reporters in newsrooms. When you have fewer reporters in newsrooms, that means fewer stories get covered, and then you have people wondering, you have people coming up to either, you know, people in the media or elected officials, be it our mayor or city council, and they're saying, the only time I see a news truck in the corner or in my block or in my neighborhood is when someone gets shot. You know, the only time you all come over here is if there's crime or if there is violence and whatnot. This is not to say that violence doesn't happen in Detroit, but, you know, life happens in the neighborhoods. Like I said earlier, you have people who have started block clubs. We have more block clubs in the city of Detroit than ever before. It's my job to go talk to them about why they started these block clubs, why they're making Detroit a home. You have more people starting businesses in Detroit than ever before. We have something called Motor City Match, in which we match, you know, if I have a nail salon or something like that, and I've got $10,000 set aside, but I need $10,000 to hire an extra nail tech or something like that, they can match the funding through all of our donors that put into the Motor City Match Fund. Things like this all are how we're trying to tackle not just funding things or fixing things, but also portraying things through our cable channels and our website. So one of the things that we did was we started a series called Beauty Block on the cable channel, where we specifically interview women business owners about the salons that they're starting up and the hairstyles that they're doing, because these are million-dollar industries right here in the city of Detroit, but nobody's talking about them because, you know, again, the focus is on, you know, Quicken Loans just bought this or Bedrock just bought that, which is, again, good, but small businesses are also the soul of Detroit. So one of the things I would encourage everyone to do is, one, we have our website, theneighborhoods.org. There's a map on the website, theneighborhoods.org/map. And you can play around on the website and see all of the different neighborhoods in Detroit. You can click on each one. You can click, like, everyone knows Midtown, but there's also, you know, Cultural Center in trying to think of some of the other places, Pole Town, and some of those other neighborhoods surrounding Midtown, where people are thinking, like, okay, Midtown's kind of crowded, but I want to live somewhere near Wayne State or something like that. Let me click around to see what else is there. When you click on each neighborhood, you can see how much is being invested in each neighborhood. You can see how many homes are in the neighborhood, how many parks are in the neighborhood, how many schools are in the neighborhood, things like that. If you go further deep into the map, you can see the demolition tracker. We should all know that the city of Detroit is tearing down homes at a rapid rate. This particular model function on the website can show, like, okay, how many homes have come down in this neighborhood. You can overlay that with a different map and see, like, okay, I see homes coming down here, and I also see the neighbors on the other side of the block investing $10,000 into their roof or $20,000 to fix a porch, because every time you have to get something fixed on your house, theoretically, you should be coming down to the city to get a permit pulled. We can track all that, and now what we're seeing is more of the neighbors are investing into their homes because they're feeling more confident about the city. So you can click around each neighborhood to see which neighborhoods are feeling more confident and therefore where it might be feasible to open a business or where it might be feasible to buy a home, where you can start to invest in Detroit. But the other thing I always encourage, you know, prior to working at the mayor's office, but while I was still, you know, freelancing and working in journalism and whatnot, is that a lot of people don't know really how to experience Detroit off a computer or off a phone or anything like that, or off some sort of screen. When I did write my first book, and it feels weird to say my first one, but I closed it with the fact that, you know, you should drive around the city. Really, really drive around the city. There, every time I go on Reddit or something like that, I can't stop going on. Anybody go on Reddit? Like, I can't stop going on Reddit, and every single time someone on the Detroit subreddit, someone says, like, is this neighborhood safe? Should I, you know, I got tickets to the Tigers game, you know, is it safe to park over here? And I just roll my eyes so hard. I'm like, oh my God. it's one of those things that gets so annoying is because there's that stigma is still there where it's just like, as soon as I cross 8 Mile, as soon as I cross Osler, if I come on the wrong side of Telegraph, something is going to go wrong. And I'm thinking to myself, I've lived in Detroit, you know, I'm about to turn 34 next week. I've lived here my entire life and I haven't had anything go wrong, you know, like cars never been stolen, anything like that. And it bothers me. It bothers me. It bothers my family that lives here. It bothers my friends that I went to high school with, that we get stuck with so many negative stereotypes about Detroit. And it's just like, if you just drive around and see the whole city outside of downtown, then maybe you would learn something. You know, it takes more than, you know, reading one slideshow about, you know, look at all these abandoned buildings, right? Or it takes more than, you know, like, oh, this one person opened a business, therefore everybody, you know, can flock to this one neighborhood and open a business. The one thing I want people to take away is that you have to go out and talk to people. You have to go into a restaurant you're unfamiliar with. You have to go to a neighborhood that you're unfamiliar with. Look at the housing there. Look at the housing stock. You might like it, you might not like it. But you have to get off the screens. You have to get off the screens. Get out of the comment sections. Get off Facebook. You know, it happens. You know, people say, I'm moving to Detroit. And then underneath the comments, you know, all of their uncles and aunts are just like, oh, be careful. Get a gun. You know. All of these types of things, and that's, you know, in order for Detroit to progress as a city, and not just as a city, as a region as a whole, because so Detroit goes, so does the rest of Southeast Michigan. Even if you never cross 8 Mile, and we all should know by now, if this city fails, Oakland and Macomb and Washtenaw and everything else is going to go right down with it. So we all got to start working together now, you know. I don't know how anybody feels about Elk Brooks Patterson, but. Maybe I should not go there, but this is a historic time in Detroit. This is, I always say, the time is now. You know, the time is now to invest in Detroit, buy a home here, start a business here. There are people, you know, if you are connected with a firm that, you know, needs more bodies to make widgets or whatever, you know, there are people here that need work. And it's not just they're sitting around waiting to find a job. The city is giving them training programs and things like that. So we've got thousands of people going through training programs every day looking for work. And we can't keep up with the demand because people are coming out of the training programs and getting jobs just as quickly. And we're going to reach a point where we're going to have a surplus. So we need more employers here. But not only that, there's plenty, I mean, even if you're not trying to start a business, there's plenty of housing that needs to be sold. And the prices are going up. The prices are going up. So this, like I said, now is the time. I've been trying to convince my friends who are currently renting. I'm just like, you guys want to hurry up and get in on this before you can't afford it. Because pretty soon, you know, we are going to reach a point where housing, it's not going to happen now. It's not going to happen next 5 years. But people are going to look back and say, oh, I wish I would have bought that house. Or I wish I would have did that. This is the time to really get to know the city. You know, get to know the parts of Detroit that you don't really know. It's more than Midtown, more than Corktown, more than downtown. I don't live in any of those three neighborhoods, and yet I am having the time of my life. I am doing just fine. So I think we have just enough time for the Q&A. I live in the Gold Coast, which is on Jefferson, just east of Belle Isle. You've got Jefferson Chalmers on one side, Indian Village on the other side. I was like, I would really love to live in Indian Village, but I don't want a 5,000 square foot house, so I have a one bedroom condo in a high rise that's just me and my cat. So, but I grew up in Russell Woods. I grew up in Dexter Davis. Who's heard of Russell Woods? See, one person, two people. Russell Woods, for those who don't know, is a community on the west side, the intersection of Dexter and Davidson. Now, I tell some people I'm from Dexter and Davidson. They're like, "Oh, you grew up on Dexter Ave." And I'd be like, "Yeah, I did. So what?" But it's one of those communities that Detroit is proud of. It has a long history of being, it was originally a Jewish neighborhood, but it was one of the first neighborhoods on the west side to integrate to African Americans. And if you were to go down a who's who of Detroit in the 1950s and 60s, chances are that they lived in Russell Woods. We lived there from the 90s up until very recently, when my mom decided to downsize. But it's one of those neighborhoods that is off the map to everyone that doesn't live there because they never heard of it, or they hear Dexter and they're like, "Oh, I'm not going there in Dexter," you know. So,
yeah, I was gonna say, I've got a couple questions in the app, so maybe I'll ask those. And for everyone else that wants to get some questions in, grab up your app real quick, click on the session, and submit some questions real quick. So, one on here that caught my attention, we were talking about it briefly, is for those of us that haven't read your book, can you describe what we need to know to not be a jackass while in Detroit?
What you should know to not be a jackass. Well, one of the reasons why I wrote the book is because I saw a lot of people were moving to Detroit and kind of basing their knowledge about Detroit based on what happened in the last decade. So what happened in the last decade was, again, foreclosure, recession, Kwame went to jail, right? And people are just like, well, if Kwame didn't do this, then Detroit wouldn't be the state that it's in. A lot of people forget that, or a lot of people just aren't aware that Detroit's problems did not begin in 2001 when Kwame Kilpatrick was elected. They began far before that. I would trace it back to the 1800s even. A good starting point would be the 1940s when a few things were happening at the same time. You had more African Americans coming into Detroit from the South than ever before. You also had more suburbs being built around the city perimeter, and you had the freeways being built. So 1940s, no surprise that the population started dropping off after then, because what was happening? White flight was happening, yep. So you had the population peaked. You had race riots in the 1940s. You had race riots, of course, we know the big one in 1967. But there was a race riot in, I can't remember the year, 1800 and something. But almost as long as black people have been in Detroit, there's been animosity between both races, right? Between black residents and white residents. In the 1800s, Second Baptist Church, the first, wasn't the first Baptist church, but it was the first black church in the city. They were growing in such stature because more of the ex-slaves were starting to populate the congregation and whatnot, that they started like raising more money and doing more churchy activities than the other Baptist church. And so it was burned down, you know, burned down just because. And they had rebuilt Second Baptist Church and, you know, start all over again. But that was one of the earliest race riots in Detroit. I say that to say that as Detroit changes, as the demographic changes, as the population changes, you have to understand that a lot of people are kind of carrying this history on their shoulders. You know, there are people who are still alive who remember the riots of 1967. There are people who are still alive that remember 375 that we all take downtown, including me, to get to work. That paved through Black Bottom and Paradise Valley, which were two historic African-American neighborhoods where a lot of people were displaced, and a million-dollar entertainment industry was destroyed due to urban renewal. A lot of people still remember that. So when people are moving to Detroit, people kind of have the longtime residents can sometimes have that fear that history could repeat itself. You know, not necessarily a race riot or a freeway going through, but that feeling of displacement when a new person is coming into the city. So I write a lot about like sort of this tension that exists and how people can alleviate that tension. And it's simple things like if you want to open a business in Detroit, you know, ask the neighborhood what kind of business they need rather than forcing a business upon them. It's happened a few times in other cities where it's just like a neighborhood, they want a simple coffee shop where they can sit down and get a cup of coffee for $1 or $2. And then a business owner or an entrepreneur will come in and say, you know what, we're going to have $10 cupcakes and organic this and organic that, and it's going to be unaffordable to you guys, but someone's going to come and get it. Well, someone's going to come and get it and then gentrify the neighborhood, right? That's what happens. Detroit is in a position where we can sort of avoid some of these problems. There's a lot of businesses opening in Detroit, but the entrepreneurs here are getting smarter, right? They've looked to see what has happened in San Francisco and Brooklyn, and they're saying we don't want to open the kind of business where it could accidentally or inadvertently gentrify the neighborhood, but we still want to, you know, find a place here, take advantage of the opportunity here. So those conversations are now being had. Those conversations are being had where we can avoid gentrification and avoid displacing residents. But, you know, sometimes people slip through the cracks, and sometimes people don't always, listen to what people are saying. So that's some of the things I talk about in the book.
So maybe quickly expand on that, because we had a couple questions about gentrification. So one of them was around, you know, how should new white Detroiters balance, you know, their excitement to live in certain parts of the city to avoid gentrification, and then also just around reinvestment, right? What is your advice to non-residents, white non-residents wanting to come, but, you know, there's a risk, I think, of gentrification, which is real, and you just mentioned it. So what advice do you have around that topic?
If you talk to any longtime resident of Detroit, you know, nobody wants to live next to an abandoned house, right? No one wants to live next to an empty house. Everybody wants neighbors. What people don't want is a neighbor that, black or white or whoever, nobody wants a neighbor that is unfriendly to people. I said before that, like, I grew up in a neighborhood where everybody knew each other. You know, people have been living in that neighborhood like 40, 50 years, and, you know, you just knew everybody on the block. I refer to a story that happened in Southwest. You know, Southwest Detroit is a majority Latino area, and it's also got great proximity to Corktown and downtown and things like that. So it's become attractive to younger white residents who may not necessarily want to live in Midtown but still want to have a close proximity to it. And, you know, I always refer to this story where a young white couple had bought a house in Southwest and didn't speak to anybody on the block. You know, this is a neighborhood where, like I said, everybody knows each other. The one person that moved out had probably lived there for a long time. And then you have a young couple that moves in, and they're throwing parties there, and they're inviting all of their friends, and they're not friendly with anybody else on the block. That's probably the number one mistake people make. You know, it's not necessarily just their presence in the neighborhood, but it's that feeling of, like, I'm too good to talk to you. You know, I'm too good to socialize with you. So I always tell people, you know, say hi to people, you know, nod, you know, start a conversation. I'm not saying you have to, like, go on their front door and ask for a teaspoon of sugar or anything like that. But these neighborhoods are populated with people who have lived there for a long time, and they know everybody. So when you come into a neighborhood and you're not friendly with them, you know, you have to remember, we're the Midwest. And we're also the Midwest with a lot of people of Southern roots. So there's a lot of hospitality. There's a lot of friendliness. But, you know, I have a friend that lives in the 1300 Lafayette Tower. And a lot of black residents have lived there since the thing was built. But he always passes on to me, like, the number one thing he says is, like, he says, all the older black residents are always talking to each other. But you always see the younger white people who are moving to the building on their phones, you know. Again, like, not saying hi, not saying this, not saying that, not acknowledging other people's presence. I'm going to feel disrespected if, like, I'm on an elevator and you come in and, like, not say anything, or you just tell me to press the button. Like, can you press 4 for me? Hello? Like, you know, things like that is what create, you know, it's that that snowball that turns into an avalanche, you know. The other thing, what was the other part of the question?
I think you've touched on a lot of stuff in terms of gentrification, but it was just about how, you know, when we consider moving somewhere in terms of investment, you know, what are things to consider when new white residents, non-residents, are looking to come to Detroit?
We can learn the lessons from other cities. So we hear over and over and over again about, you know, something out of Brooklyn where the police are being called to deal with, like, the dude standing on the block not doing anything wrong, right? Or, you know, suddenly, like, the things that were not an issue for 10, 20, 30 years are suddenly an issue. Why is he out in the park? Why is he standing here? Why, you know, why is this? This is where Detroit can learn, right? Because, like I said, it is happening in Brooklyn. It's happening in Austin. It's happening in San Francisco. This is the point where we can say, like, this, we are not going to call the police on someone that's minding their own business, right? The other thing that was kind of a hot trend a couple of years ago but has seemed to cooled off is the renaming of neighborhoods. It's happened more than a few times where the example we all point to is in Corktown. There is an area west of Slo's, west of Michigan Ave, going towards Southwest. And a couple had bought an empty bank there. And there's actually two examples from Corktown. It always seems to happen there, doesn't it? But a couple had bought an abandoned bank, restored it. It's gorgeous. There's all these photos and curbed and whatnot. And all of their friends started coming over, and they're just like, oh, I love this house. I love this. But what neighborhood is this? It's not quite Corktown. It's not quite Southwest. And they kind of joked around and said, well, maybe since it's not Corktown, we should call it West Corktown. Next thing you know, T-shirts were made. A website was made. And then the people on the other side of Michigan Ave were just like, when did we start calling this West Corktown? It's called Core City. If you go just a few blocks over, there are signs called Core City. There was a Core City Community Development Corporation that was founded in the 80s. This name has been around for a good 30 years. Neighborhood renaming is generally the first step towards gentrification, because suddenly a new name catches fire, becomes attractive, and then people start developing interest in there, probably not in the way that it should be. All neighborhoods are interesting. People are moving in there, but it can very quickly get out of control too fast, because if West Corktown would have stuck, it probably would have been the new hot thing, and next thing you know, we've got all these, again, a lot of businesses people may not necessarily afford, a lot of things that people may not necessarily afford. Instead of sort of gradually like introducing things, now it's like the new hot thing. So West Corktown was shut down, and now people acknowledge it as Core City. But it's happened a few other times. Like, some people have tried to call the area near Green Dot like South Corktown or Corktown Shores or something like that. The area near Whole Foods, Noma, north of Mac. Like, why do we need that? Like, it's fine. It's Midtown. It's fine. You know?
All right. Well, hey, everybody. I'd like to put our hands together and thank Aaron. Thank you so much for sharing.